It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
You're listening to C103's Cork Today podcast. Phone and text lines are currently closed.
As we welcome you along to the programme, and a reminder to you that today is May Eve, so we will be talking about May Eve traditions later on the programme with folklorist Michael Fortune. But if there's any particular tradition that you remember that was perhaps celebrated in your household for May Eve, let us know about them. You can text or WhatsApp 0862 103 103. John Paul also taking calls at 0818 103 103. I think we thought all our rowing between the Irish and the British government were behind us. Well, it looks like it's not. We now have the Justice Minister, our own Helen McEntee, pushing ahead now with new laws. And these are new laws which will be aimed at allowing the Irish government, allowing the deportation of asylum seekers to the UK, even though we're hearing very strongly from the British government that they've already indicated that they won't accept us returning any refugees that came from the UK. A major diplomatic row has now developed between the UK Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, more than happy to stare down Helen McEntee on the issue of immigration. Ministers believe the UK position is just posturing, but they've also conceded that they've now handed the Conservative government a pre-election gift by suggesting its threat to send migrants to Rwanda is now leading to this influx of people leaving the UK and coming to Ireland instead. Helen McEntee is now likely to come under even more pressure, and this was after it emerged her claims that the 80% of asylum seekers coming to Ireland are crossing the border from the north. Now, seemingly that's not based on any statistical evidence. And I remember, and I said it on air when that figure was released last week or the week before, I remember thinking, where's the figures to back that up? But anyway, she's pressing ahead. She's bringing legislation before the cabinet today, and that to have the UK designated as a safe country. And that's important because then applicants from people who were there first can be processed faster if they've come from what's deemed a safe country, and therefore, if appropriate, they can be deported. And remember, there was a High Court ruling just last month, and because of that High Court ruling, it removed the safe designation from the UK, and that's been cited by government as an unexpected consequence of Brexit. Social Protection Minister Heather Humphrey, she was out yesterday saying that these rules have always existed, and they existed before March until that High Court case. So she's saying all they want to do is just restore the rules that were already in place. Asked about comments from senior British figures, including Rishi Sunak, in the past 48 hours, she says that the context was important. And she said, you have to remember there's local elections this week in the UK, and that's the only reason that Rishi Sunak and other senior figures are saying what they're saying. But listen, this is what Rishi, the British Prime Minister, had to say just yesterday.
Can you get a return scheme with Ireland, do you think?
I'm not interested in that. We're not going to accept returns from the EU via Ireland when the EU doesn't accept returns back to France where illegal migrants are coming from. Of course we're not going to do that. I'm determined to get our Rwanda scheme up and running because I want a deterrent. I want it to be the case.
So is there a negotiation with the EU that this could be part of?
No. Okay. I'm focused squarely on getting our Rwanda scheme up and running. I want the deterrent which will say that if you come to our country illegally, you will not be able to stay and you will be removed. Either to your own country if it's safe, or Rwanda. That's why I've worked so hard at this. That's why we've done all the prep work for this. And actually, I want that deterrent up and running, and I'm confident that it will work.
And he, of course, then is picking up on this comment of the 80% of asylum seekers coming into Ireland, crossing over the border. He's saying, look, My contentious Rwanda policy is simply working. Now, the Irish government believes it can restore the status quo, which would mean that an asylum seeker who arrives here from the UK will be allowed to spend less time in state accommodation and given suitable rights if their application is approved, but they still will have to be processed. Migrants who were refused and deported may end up then with what's called a negative immigration record, and that obviously impacts on their ability to travel internationally forevermore. Ministers hope that this will slow in some way the high numbers of migrants who are crossing the border. Rishi Sunak, it says, is being viewed as desperate among EU countries for putting up a last effort just to woo voters with the local elections in the UK. Now, privately, ministers said last night that the processing times will now be the true test of the asylum system for Minister Helen McEntee. One minister pointed to the Taoiseach, Simon Harris. What he's doing, he's taking pressure off the Equality Minister, Roderick O'Gorman, but instead he's heaping the pressure now onto the Justice Minister, Helen McEntee, when it comes to immigration. Fianna Fáil Justice spokesperson, that's Jim O'Callaghan. He says that the government should be taking measures it can control instead of being used for political purposes. Now, this row over the 80% coming, the Department of Justice, they're the ones who gave those figures to Helen McEntee. They're standing by the assessment that the majority of asylum seekers are coming into the country through the north. Now, they don't give any specific figures, but what they're basing it on is the number of people who claim asylum either at a ferry port or an airport are those who go directly in to the IPO offices in the city. So what they're assuming is that those that just turn up at the offices in the city centre, that they must have crossed over the border. And that's what they are basing their figure of 80%. But the Irish Refugee Council, they're also questioning that figure. Nick Henderson is the CEO of the Irish Refugee Council. He said, just because a person has not applied for protection at an airport or a port, it doesn't automatically mean that that person has crossed the border from Northern Ireland. He said, a person may pass through immigration control and then apply for international protection at the International Protection Office in the city centre. He said some of them may not want to apply at the airport or the port because they think they'll be placed back on a plane and returned, and they feel that would put them at risk of persecution. And they're saying, look, we simply don't know how the Department of Justice came up with that figure of 80%. And it's also backed up by Fiona Hurley, who is CEO of the migrant rights group NASC. And she gives an example of somebody who might have been actually here in this country legally, who then looks for asylum. And an example she gave was you could have a Sudanese national who was here on a work permit, or maybe somebody came here as a student, and then because of the crisis situation in Sudan, they find it is no longer safe for them to return home to their country. So they then may go to the IPO office and present, but they would not have come through the UK and certainly wouldn't have come down over the border. But I thought when the Social Protection Minister, Heather Humphreys, made her point that all Helen McEntee is doing is putting rules that existed before March. They were there until the High Court decided that the UK wasn't a safe country. Well, the Irish Daily Mail are leading with appeal that not one asylum seeker was ever sent back to the UK under that post-Brexit returns policy. And that's the one that the Minister for Justice is set to reintroduce today. So while the law might have been always there, there wasn't one asylum seeker sent back. And you can kind of understand why Rishi Sunak is, you know, shouting from the rooftops about how his Rwanda policy is working. Because if you look, before I came on air this morning, I was just looking at the number of people who are entering the UK trying to claim asylum there. And the figures are absolutely huge. Like the figures for last year, for 2023, 84,825 people claimed asylum in the UK. And at the peak of asylum applications in the UK was back back in 2002 when that figure was actually just slightly lower. It was just over 84,000. So they've had stages where it has gone as high as 84,000, and then it dropped off a number of years. Then it started to rise rapidly again. And then obviously since Brexit, when they thought they were going to completely be able to control their borders, the figures have just gone up and up and up since 2021 to that figure last year of 84,425. And on the numbers of people who are refused, 24% of them are refused, so the rest are allowed to stay. And looking at the UK, the most common area for asylum seekers was Asia. The most common single nationality was Afghan in the UK. And in recent years, the Middle East was the most common region, with Syria and Iran, obviously with what's happening in those countries. But 84,500 individuals claimed asylum in the UK last year. And when you look at our figures, that figure was at 13,000. 0818 103 103. Where is this row going to end between the Irish and British government? I mean, if we decide that we are going to send them back to the UK, what happens when we're hearing that the British government are refusing to take them? Where do we go from there? Some of your thoughts on how do we handle the situation with the immigration row that's brewing between Ireland and the UK. John says, Patricia, are we heading back to the days of the black and tans with the UK? Some things never change. Someone else says, Ireland should join the UK Rwanda scheme. Send them directly from here to Rwanda to be processed. Our government are beyond incompetent at this stage, maybe the worst in the history of the state, according to this listener. They're taken over by NGOs and lunatics. Common sense must be the default setting once more. Common sense dictates to this letter that to this listener that our government needs replacing. And Mick says he watched news on two different TV channels last night, and not one asked the First Minister in the North where they stood on people crossing the border. Are they afraid of Sinn Féin, says Mick. I saw her speaking about it at the weekend. I don't know if anybody, Michelle O'Neill, I saw her saying that nobody has come to her to say what's going on in the North, and I don't know how much of it she would actually know how much is going on, unless they're going to stand and start counting how many people are getting on buses. Dermot in Macroom says, can Ireland and the UK not join forces and set up a scheme whereby migrants from both countries are sent to Rwanda for processing? Ireland and the UK are on the edge of Europe and have more in common with each other than others in Europe. So Dermot feels some kind of a link up between the two countries. But of course, I mean, we're now looking at a country that's outside of Brexit. And Dermot says, don't forget, Michael O'Leary of Ryanair was out at the weekend, and he offered to put on the planes to fly the migrants back to Rwanda. Yeah, but I don't think he was talking about doing that free of charge, by the way, Dermot. I think he was seeing it as a way of making money. Someone else is questioning, is Helen McEntee now far right in wanting to send asylum seekers and refugees to other countries? Is that not what the far right have been shouting about? Someone else says, Patricia, please remember, people have been coming from the UK to Ireland for years. Ireland, we do not have direct flight or ferries from most of the countries where the asylum seekers are coming from. We don't have direct flights from Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, or indeed any other parts of Africa. It's always been through the UK, with a much smaller amount coming through Paris and Amsterdam. Hi, Patricia. The government are playing with fire quite literally by trying to appease people's baseless fears when it comes to asylum seekers. The government engage with dehumanising language like IPAs, International Protection Applicants. And Helen McEntee spreading fake news, I'm assuming that's the 80% figure, is better than any conspiracy WhatsApp group. Then they say they will not tolerate violence from the far right or the far left. The, in inverted commas, far left is not campaigning on hate. They're not the ones burning buildings, and they're not the ones threatening bombs. But as they say, if you play with fire, you might get burnt. And that's exactly what's happening now for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. OK, that's just some of your comments coming into the programme this morning. Keep them coming. On last night's Crime Call programme, the Gardaí launched a special appeal for information on one of Ireland's highest profile missing persons case. Conor and Sheila Dwyer simply disappeared from their home and their lives in Fermoy. And today marks the 33rd anniversary of the last time the couple were seen in public. Ralph Regan, Southern correspondent with the Irish Independent, joins me. Good morning to you, Ralph.
Good morning, Patricia.
By the way, have you been almost covering this case from the start?
Yes and no. Initially, I would have been aware of it and would have filed some material on it. I wouldn't have been exclusively on it back in the 90s. But I suppose, being honest, towards the end of the 90s and into the noughties, yes, I would have been doing an awful lot of work on it on the basis of Garda appeals, any updates. And of course, what has happened in recent years is it's really focused around anniversary appeals, because that's when the Gardaí really find that people are engaged with it around the time that it happened, and appeals for information or appeals for details on the vehicle, things like that.
Yeah, just trying to get somebody to try and jog their memories, some little bit of tidbit of information. So it was this day back in 1991. Just talk us through where they were last seen on this day 33 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, Connor was 62, Sheila was 61, and they vanished without trace 33 years ago today. Now, today wasn't the last contact with them, because the following day, on May the 1st, Sheila, I think, had been in contact with family members by telephone. But the last time they were seen in public was today. They lived in Chapel Hill, which is in the shadow of St. Patrick's Church in Fermoy, and they were going to a Requiem Mass. So they were seen near the church by a local girl. They exchanged a few words. I think the local girl's name was Catherine Fenton. Exchanged a few words. And that was the last reported sighting of Connor and Sheila Dwyer. As I said, Sheila was in contact with her family the following day, May the 1st. On May the 22nd, her family became very concerned. The repeated attempts to contact Connor or Sheila had failed, both at their home and at the property in Castle Lyons where Connor worked. The Gardaí were notified, and Gardaí gained access to the property. Now, they went into the property. There was a sum of cash found inside. There were travel documents. All of their clothing was there. All of their luggage was there. There was no sign of a disappearance. Everything was normal within the house. There was a collection of letters unopened at the front door where they'd been delivered by the postman. And despite a massive guard investigation over the years, all of the original members of the Garda investigation team have retired. I mean, you would Sergeant Joe Watkins, you'd have John Conway, you'd have had Tom Ryan, a lot of the detectives and Gardaí in Fermoy that were involved in it, they're all retired at this point. It's currently being led by Detective Sergeant James O'Shea. And despite everything, despite an investigation that has even liaised with Interpol, there has been no trace whatsoever of Connor and Sheila Dwyer. The only thing that was missing from the property alongside Connor and Sheila was their white Toyota Cressida car, and the registration number of that car was 5797ZT. And the Cressida was quite an unusual car, quite a distinctive car. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of Toyota Corollas. The Cressida was a much more unique niche market car, so it did stand out. But despite everything, checks at ports, airports, motor factors, dealers, garages, parking lots, there has been no trace of the vehicle.
And of course, we're talking over 30 years ago, CCTV wouldn't have been available at the time, would it?
No, I mean, there were a number of issues that actually had hampered the guard investigation in the beginning. First of all, I mean, you didn't have CCTV security networks the way you do today. We've seen in various trials in Dublin, Cork and Limerick over recent years that the movements of people can be traced on a minute by minute basis because of the number of private security cameras that are in a place. Of course, this is long before that. So there's no indication of where Connor and Sheila went. There's no capture of them at any specific location that might have indicated where they were headed. There's no captures of the vehicle. Of course, it's also the era before mobile phones. So the ability to ping someone's mobile phone and to see where they might have gone or where the mobile phone, what masts it was pinging off in terms of indicating a general direction, all of those things weren't available to the Gardaí at the time. And of course, the thing that they depend most on is the assistance of the public. And no one saw Connor and Sheila Dwyer. So there was no one, there was no eyewitness statements. There was no one able to say, well, look, I definitely saw them at such and such a place. Gardaí did get some information. There was, I think, a reported sighting in Germany in 1993. And there was also another reported sighting from France. But Gardaí, having worked with the German and police and with Interpol, looked at the sightings and actually came to believe that they were well-intentioned but mistaken reports, and that the individuals involved were actually not Conor and Sheila Dwyer.
Yeah, and I'm assuming the German one was possibly taken very seriously because he did have a connection to a German businessman.
Exactly. And I think that's why the Gardaí looked long and hard at that German report, because Conor had worked as a chauffeur, as a handyman, as a kind of an executive assistant for a man called Fritz Wolf. He was a very wealthy German businessman, and he had a property in Castle Lyons just outside Fermoy. And Conor's job was that he would maintain this man's fleet of luxury vehicles, which I think one of them was actually a Rolls Royce. And of course, Conor would have been quite a high profile figure in Fermoy because of his association with these vehicles. I mean, I suppose Porsches and Ferraris and all of these flash cars are not exactly unusual in post-Celtic Tiger Ireland and in the society we live in today. But back in 1991, if you drove a car like that down the main street,
they stood out.
You'd bring the town to a standstill.
Yeah.
And people would have a good look at what type of car it was, the colour, who was driving it, who might be in the back seat. And of course, Conor would have been very high profile because of his association with those wealthy vehicles. But that man, Fritz Wolf, he had a property in Castle Lyons, and Conor had worked for him for quite some time.
And I loved the way it was recorded or spoken about last night. They would be driving around town and Sheila would be sitting in the front seat of the car. They were a very united couple, kept very much to themselves, but they were a very united couple.
Oh, very much so. I mean, they're very much devoted to their family. A lot of very good neighbours and friends, but they were a particularly close couple. I mean, if you talk to people, I mean, the way that they would describe Conor was very, very conscious of his appearance. He was always well dressed. He was always immaculately turned out, very much an old school gentleman. I mean, if he was driving and they had stopped to do the shopping, he would insist on opening the door for Sheila.
Yeah.
If they were coming out of a shop, he would insist on carrying the messages for her. When they went to places, it was always together. So they were very much a very close, very devoted couple. And I think that's what probably has made the disappearance all the more bizarre. I mean, sadly, people go missing in society all the time. And in some cases, families never get closure. But what is quite astonishing about this case is for two people to disappear and for there to be absolutely no trace in 33 years, to have absolutely no inkling, no clue, no bit of evidence as regards what actually happened to the two of them.
Have they children?
They do. They had two children. None of the children were in Fermoy at the time.
Okay.
I think one was overseas, and I think one, there's a bit of a confusion of whether both were overseas or whether one was overseas and one was working up the country. But yes, they do. The two, and about 10 years ago, there was a documentary done on the disappearance, and I think one of the sons had actually cooperated with that. They fully endorsed the appearance on Crime Call last night, and the Garda appealed for information. And clearly, I mean, everybody wants closure for the family, and especially I think for the children, because it must be, you know, an absolute
very tough
nightmare for 33 years not to know what actually happened to your mom and dad. So I think particularly within the community of Fermoy, everybody wants to do right by this family. Everybody wants to do what they can to try and give them closure and end what has been, you know, the most baffling of 33-year mysteries.
What did you make of the interview last night with a former colleague of Conor, Peter Massey? I mean, he described him as, you know, as a lovely, kind, gentle and honest man. But he felt he was a bit off in the weeks leading up to the disappearance.
Yeah, I think it's extraordinary, Patricia, to be honest, because that's the first I've heard of that. And I've been covering this case for 33 years. And certainly the indication I have from a lot of the Gardaí, that's the first that they had. Certainly the original Gardaí involved in the investigation, that's the first that a lot of them have heard of this particular commentary on the demeanour or the attitude of Conor Dwyer. And I think in some ways it is a significant development in the case in terms of possibly indicating that was there something going on? Was there a difficulty? Because up until now, all the indications are that there was nothing. I mean, sometimes people go missing for many different reasons. In some particular cases, it's because of an extraneous cause that someone might be worried about something or fearful of something or whatever. But there was never any indication up until now that that was the case here.
Okay, so the house, I'm assuming, long gone, long sold.
Yeah, the house was sold, I think, well over a decade ago, possibly even 20 years ago. And I think any of the assets for the family would have obviously been sorted through the children. So, you know, Chapel Hill is still there. The property is still there, but it has long since passed out of the Dwyer family's hands.
OK, so the Gardaí now looking back over the case again. And as you say, all of the Gardaí who would have initially been involved now retired. Will they go back to them? Will they help out on a case?
Oh, they already
this?
Have been. Oh, they have. Yeah, there have been interviews. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There was over the last year, a lot of the original Gardaí in the case have been contacted by the current case team. They've spoken to them. Was there anything that stood out to them? Were there any was there any lines of inquiry that the current Gardaí need to focus on? So there's been a lot of effort put into that. Again, a lot of effort put into the car, because I think Gardaí have always believed if they could find the car, or if they could find what happened to the car, it would go a long way towards giving them the breakthrough that they need in this case.
OK, well, hopefully after all this time that something might happen, and that the family, above anything else, that the family will get closure, and anyone who has any information, no matter how small that piece of information is, particularly people in the Fermoy area, Fermoy Garda Station, can be contacted at 0258 210 0258 210. Ralph, thank you for that. Thanks for joining
us. My pleasure.
Good morning to you. Bye-bye. Ralph Regal, Southern Correspondent with the Irish Independent, remembering this day 33 years ago, the last official sighting of Conor and Sheila Dwyer in Fermoy.
C103.
Now, yesterday, the Irish Examiner ran a piece on some of the more unusual requests that Cork councillors have received over the years from their constituents. And as we know, the famous phrase from Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. So looking after the potential vote is important for councillors. Journalist with the Irish Examiner, Sarah Horgan, who wrote the piece, joins me. Good morning to you, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, and thanks a million for taking time out to talk to us. One thing we know is that councillors are always available, even for a call at 11 o'clock at night to sort out somebody's mobile phone.
Oh, yes, that was one story, wasn't it?
That was Marie O'Sullivan.
Marie O'Sullivan, exactly. She serves the communities of Bandon and Kinsale, and she seems to take these requests in her stride. She said, but she's very happy to help people who are older or vulnerable. So she got this call at 11 o'clock anyway at night from this woman who needed help with her mobile phone. And she said that she couldn't get her mobile phone to work. She was trying to place the call and nothing. And there was three elderly sisters living together, and one of them was in hospital. So that stressed them out a lot, because they had no one to help them with their mobile phone. The woman in hospital was the sister, she was very technologically savvy. So what did Marie do? She got in her car, drove all the way to their house. And she got there and realized that the phone was on airplane mode.
Oh, bless.
You just couldn't be cross with somebody could you?
You couldn't
possibly get cross with someone like that.
And obviously no one else to call. Sure, we'll call the local councillor. And then one of our youngest, if not our youngest councillor, Ben Dalton O'Sullivan, he had an unusual request to try and find love for a man.
Yeah, he seems to be like Cupid or something, doesn't he? So he had just sorted this, there was this one man who he set up for a hip operation. As you know, he does those buses for
to
people
Belfast.
Getting cataract surgery, yeah. And all kinds of things. He's part of that initiative. But a few weeks later, he told me that one of the men was really happy with his surgery, and his only hope now was that he could sort him out with the girlfriend. So this man was in his 70s, and it just so happened that Ben Dalton O'Sullivan had another bus organized. Normally it's for people getting their cataract surgery or their hips done, but this one was going to the matchmaking festival in Listunvarna. So he said, why don't you come along? So they brought him up but he still doesn't know if he had any luck. So if he met anyone, he's not telling us. So he might be keeping it under wraps. But I would have loved to have been a passenger on that bus.
Yeah. And worth asking the councillor when they're calling looking for your vote. Any chance you might find me, love. Now, forget about Rentokil. It's Fianna Fáil councillor Fergal Dennehy is your only man if you need to get rid of rodents, particularly mice.
He seems to be a real gent. So he was asked to remove two dead mice from a hot press, which would be my worst nightmare, even though I know they're dead and they can't do anything to me. I just hate mice. So I was asking him if he was afraid of mice, and he said, thankfully he's not. And he said, when it comes to duty, you have no fear, which I love because it makes him sound like a superhero or something, doesn't it?
But it was a constituent that had these two, somebody had two dead mice that they couldn't get rid of it. So they asked him to, could he help? That was literally what happened.
Yeah, so if in doubt, call your local councillor. That's what happened. It was paid off in that instance,
it did. And of course, we're getting a lot of knocks on the doors at the moment, and we will over the next number of weeks, because all of the councillors and potential councillors are all out canvassing. So if you need hairdresser skills, then you need to go to the Green Party and Councillor Lorna Bogue.
Yeah, so most people are dreading the knock on the door, but one woman, she used it to her advantage. And on this particular occasion, Lorna Bogue, she doubled up as a last minute hairdresser. So she was canvassing in Waterford for the European elections. This was only a couple of weeks ago when she knocked on the door of a young woman who was clearly, she could tell she was getting ready to head out for the evening. She had her fab dress on and everything else, and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I've interrupted you." And she told her, "No, why don't you make yourself useful, basically, and do my hair extensions?" So Lorna Bogue actually did a really good job of the hair extensions, but she still doesn't know if she
has her vote.
Well, yeah,
she's going to have to wait and see. And Councillor John Sheehan, who also is Dr. John Sheehan, who funny enough was only on the programme yesterday, he's proof that some councillors are given very little time to try to help out a constituent. This was a woman who was demanding that John found a job for her daughter in order for her to vote for John.
Mm-hmm. So she said that if, I think, was it, you'll have to refresh my memory.
Friday was polling day, and she contacted John on the Monday. And if she wanted the vote, she had to get a job for the daughter by Friday.
Yeah, God, what kind of a job could you get someone in that space of time? I'm not sure. But he said that he was happy to sit down with her and have a chat, but he didn't have jobs in his back pocket. And that was that. He said some people want things that they know in their heart and soul aren't achievable. But you know what? They still ask anyway.
Yeah, they're certainly putting people to the test. And then, you know, I have huge admiration for people, particularly for people who get involved in local politics for this very reason, because people feel you're at their beck and call 24/7. I mean, Councillor Terry Shannon of Fianna Fáil doesn't even get Christmas Day off.
This woman made sure he didn't on this particular Christmas Day anyway. She had lost her wedding ring and thought it might have ended up in the dump, and she expected everybody to leave their turkeys and their Christmas dinners and their families and go and look for her ring, just open up the dump.
Yeah, and so even if they did manage to open up the dump, how in God's name was anyone going to be able to find a wedding ring in the dump?
Oh, it was a long shot, and she didn't even know if she just happened to see a truck going by and said, maybe they swept it up, I don't know.
And for all Fianna Fáil councillor Kevin Murphy, also on Christmas Day, 2 a.m. in the morning, his phone rings. He's not a taxi company,
by the
way. His
wife got the brunt of that. Yeah, his wife got the brunt of that. So she was able to reject the request on his behalf anyway, and say, no, there is no way my husband is going to be picking you up on Christmas morning. It was 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it was
very early.
Yeah, and obviously somebody had fallen out of the pub. There was no taxis. So they decided they'd ring the local councillor. Will you give me a lift home? It's just...
People chance their arm. And I was actually going through a list of the many crazy requests that councillors have got over the years. And another one was a walk-in wardrobe in a council house. Somebody wanted a walk-in wardrobe for their council house.
I'll have one of those as well, please, says you.
Yeah. It would be nice, wouldn't it? There was somebody wanted Ken O'Flynn to bring the lyrics board back. Do you remember that show, the lyrics board? And what takes the biscuit is there is a local councillor was once asked by a constituent to call the ESB and stop them cutting off the electricity to a home he was squatting in. And actually, a medical card for the dog. Would you like a medical card for your dog? Just ask your local councillor.
People will totally chance anything. And actually, I saw at the end of your piece yesterday, and I'll have to double check on this, does Councillor Kenneth O'Flynn, is he a good singing voice? He ended up singing Joe Doyle.
We're hearing Kieran McCarthy sing all the time, and he's a beautiful voice. But by God, Ken O'Flynn, he's West End material. I was saying a while ago I would get him to do a whole concert on the doorstep if he was canvassing. So if we had him and Sinead, between him and Sinead Shepherd and Kieran McCarthy.
We'd have a little group. We could have a band.
Oh, we would. We'd have the West End, and you could bring the West End to Cork. But oh my gosh, he's a beautiful singer. He sang with Amanda Neary a lot. And when the two of them got together, it was something else. So anyone who has any requests, he'll love me for this.
Kenneth O'Flynn. Kenneth O'Flynn is your man. And just very finally, the one that also kind of tickled my fancy was independent councillor Frank Roach, who's a great man for, you know, particularly rural issues and all of that. And he's been asked on a number of occasions, it's to try and solve marital problems, but it's because some of the farmers are working too hard and too long hours. So the wives are ringing up Frank saying, you need to do something. You need to stop them working every hour that God sends.
Yeah, so he's telling me that some of these farmers aren't even going to bed. They're sitting in their armchairs, spending all night watching the calving cameras. And the wives are asking them, do you love the cows more than you love me? So it's when he told me about their lifestyles, inverted commas, I thought he was telling me that they were going off to nightclubs or meeting other women, but no, the lifestyle is the cows. So I suppose it's very hard. You can't leave your work at work. Your work is at home. So it would be very hard to switch off, wouldn't it?
Yeah, work of a farmer is never done, Sarah. Ask any of them. Listen, it was a really, really great piece. Well done and very well written yesterday. Thank you for that and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Bye-bye. That is Sarah Horgan, journalist with the Irish Examiner. Can I go back to yesterday? Because towards the close of the programme, we started talking about stalking. And this was a kind of a twofold thing. I mentioned that I'd watched that Netflix programme, Baby Reindeer, over the weekend, which one of the main storylines in it is it's a stalking story, and it's an incredible watch. And it's frightening to think the lengths that a stalker can go. And it was a young would-be comedian working in a bar in London, and he felt sorry for this woman that came into the pub, and he just befriended her, and he was just kind to her. Kind of random act of kindness is how it started out. And out of that, she had obviously had extreme mental health issues, and she developed into her brain that they were in this relationship, which they weren't in, and he was never in a relationship with her, and it led to many, many months and months and months of dreadful stalking and harassment. So anyway, I was talking about that and tying bring it in with a phone call that we'd in from a listener. We just called her Anne. She didn't want it to be identified, who spoke about, she lives on her own, and she spoke about, again, it was an act of kindness. There was some people working in a field nearby, and she'd gone out to offer to fill their kettle with boiling water so they could have a cup of tea with their lunch. And she, that was, it was a simple thing, but one of the men who was working in the field, for some strange reason, took a shine to her and took a fancy to her, and she started to notice that he was passing her house a lot, and he was keeping an eye on her house, and he got to work out that she lived alone. You know, there was only, she only ever hung out women's clothes on the clothesline, and he started monitoring when she was leaving the house. And she came home from mass one day and found him walking around her house, and according to her neighbours, he'd been there for about an hour waiting for her. And then he opened up and said that, you know, he knew she lived alone, and he wanted to know, would she like to go for a cup of coffee? Would she like to go for dinner? Would she like to go for a drink? Basically, would she like to go on a date? And she said, absolutely no way. And then she asked him to stop pestering her. And luckily, the neighbours had seen the interaction and they came over and helped her out. Now, thankfully, he did go off and he did go away. But she was just making the point, can somebody not just chat to another man or a woman? It works the opposite way as well. Can a man not chat to a woman? Why does everybody think that? Why does everybody get the feeling that it's going to lead to something else? And she was just wanted us to talk about the whole issue of stalking. Well, Emma was on to us to say she works in a shop, and that a gentleman started calling in, and suddenly he was calling in every single day. He wasn't buying much, just was coming in for the chat. Was obviously a bit on the lonely side. And again, Emer being a friendly type that she was chatting away to him, and he wasn't interfering with anybody else in the shop, but he'd stay for hours on end chatting to her. Now, he eventually then started to say that he was hoping that maybe they could get together and would they go out on a date. And she said she laughed it off at first and said, no, look, I'm not really interested. But then she said one day she was locking up the shop and he was outside, and she said that kind of frightened her, that he was there while she was on her own locking up and making her way home. So again, he started asking her out, and she explained that, look, I'm only in my 30s. There was an age difference. He was slightly older. And then she said, look, I actually have a boyfriend. Now, eventually, she was forced to change her shifts, and obviously he was calling in and they weren't saying what time she was going to be on duty. So I think he kind of got the hint because he stopped going into the shop. But she said what it really freaked her out was him turning up when she was locking up the shop, but also when she started saying, oh, well, look, I can't go out on a date with you. I actually have a boyfriend. He started saying, you've never spoken about your boyfriend before, implying that it either you don't have a boyfriend or it obviously isn't serious. And she's just making the point that some people can get out of hand. I felt he thought he had a right in the end to stand and talk to me for most of the day, and that he felt I should be going out on a date with him. And she just left her all a little bit unnerved. And then Katie was on, and she listened with great interest to Anne's story about the man stalking her, because she found herself in a similar situation. She said her husband passed away about 5 years ago. And she said in the last year or so, this particular incident happened. She was at a funeral. She was in the queue. And Anne actually told a similar story to us as well. Anyway, Katie was in the queue chatting to, like, not just one person, chatting to a number of people who were standing waiting to go in. And she said, you know, everybody was just chatting with each other and, you know, sharing tidbits and, you know, obviously talking about the person that died and all of that, because she said they were all heading into the same funeral. So she said it was about an hour, busy, you know, it was busy funeral, so it was about an hour. She said it was a nice, pleasant conversation that everybody was having, but in a group. It wasn't just her. There was one particular man, but she said there was others as well all chipping in on the conversation. So she said after she sympathised, she obviously signed the condolence book and said goodbye to the group of people and said, look, it was lovely to meet you, and went off about her business. Well, she said about 2 weeks later, the man that she had spoken to in the queue arrived at her door, actually knocked on her door. He had ended up calling to neighbours to find out exactly where she lived, and he had tracked her down. He thought and mentioned, we'd a lovely chat that night at the removal, and I thought you might be interested in taking it further. Now, Katie said, well, I was flattered. I was also worried to think that somebody would actually go to that length to track me down. I politely said no, and while no harm was caused and the man went off on his way and hasn't interacted with her since, I was worried, she said, for a few weeks afterwards, the very fact that I live alone and that he'd made inquiries from my neighbour, you know, was I widowed, was I single, you know, finding out all the information about her. To the point now, she says, since that happened last year, when she does go to funerals, she'll sign her name, but she doesn't say where she lives. And the very same story Anne had of somebody being tracked down because they wrote their town's land into the condolence book, which we all do. We'll all put an address down on it. So be careful of that for fear that you might end up being stalked. And then somebody else says, Patricia, stalking is a form of abuse. And I'm so glad to hear abuse against men being included in this discussion. We don't hear enough about male victims because men don't feel that it's manly to talk about it when nothing could be further from the truth. As a woman, I've helped a male relative through a situation of horrendous abuse and it was all so extremely difficult. And where a gentleman is married to an abusive woman, especially where there are children, he's totally trapped. A woman can leave with the children, but a man can't leave at all. Cannot leave an abusive relationship because he knows if he leaves, he'll be leaving the abusive woman with the children and they'll have no protection without his presence. Yeah, and that's something that happens and we don't talk about it a lot because I think the statistics are there that the most of particularly physical abuse is a man to a woman, but that doesn't mean that men don't live in abusive situations. I know I heard of, it was a story from up the north I heard of a man who was in a very abusive relationship with his wife and two young children, a lot of course of control going on, and he had opened up to work colleagues but he hadn't opened up to anybody else, he hadn't opened up to his family, and unfortunately the course of control got so bad that this man took his own life, and it was only afterwards that his workmate started talking to the family saying, you know, are you aware that he was in a very abusive relationship? And then I think to really add to the sadness for the family of that man who ended up taking his own life and actually left a note outlining what had been happening was the mother of the children, the woman who was causing the abuse, she then completely alienated his family from the children, from the grandparents and the aunts and the uncles, and any time at Christmas or at birthdays when they tried to send presents, they were all returned. So they not only lost their beloved son and brother, but they also lost the children as well. So yes, I absolutely accept that abuse against men does happen, but unfortunately it's not discussed enough. And I think because you're right, I think a lot of men are embarrassed by the situation and they're embarrassed about, you know, reaching out and getting help. I think it's changing slightly because we do, if you speak to any of the domestic violence groups, they will tell you that more men are starting to come forward, but much more slower than, and indeed for women, it can be very hard to come forward as well. But I think there's that manly thing about men, you know, men don't cry, and sure, how could a man be the victim of abuse? 0818 103 103. Our lines are open.
C103 Jobs.
An early years practitioner. You need to have QQI level 5 is wanted to work in the Liscarroll area. CVs please to liscarrollcommunitycresh@gmail.com. General construction worker is wanted for work for the North Cork and South Limerick areas. 063 698 39. Ground workers are wanted for work in Mahon. CVs to jobs@hamiltonfrench.com. And an apprenticed carpenter wanted for first and second fixing and roofing. Now, transport of various jobs on Cork Southside is essential. Hours are from 8:30 to 5 p.m. And CVs, please, to DeclanRigney82@gmail.com. You'll find all the details and many more job opportunities by going online now. Just go to c103.ie/jobs for more. This is C103.
Cork Today on C103.
With McCarthy Insurance Group, proud sponsors of the Cork GAA Club Football Leagues and Championships. Want great advice? You know who to talk to. CMIG.ie.
Now, the Kilbeheny community have set up a GoFundMe page to help out a former homeless young man who they now call one of their own almost, sharing his story of how a chance encounter saved his life. I'm joined by Cian Murta, who is originally from County Meath, but now classes the people of Kilbeheny as almost family. Good morning to you, Cian.
Good morning, Patricia.
You're very welcome to the programme, and thank you for taking time out to talk to us, because this is really one of those, I suppose, gorgeous stories showing humanity, I suppose, at its very best. But I suppose to get a feel for this story, we need to go back. You ended up in homelessness. Was it because you were in state care for most of your life?
Unfortunately,
it's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze,
relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Everyone has ups and downs in life, and you know, there's bits where you have to recover from, you know, like, or even, how do I put it? When you're young, you know, if you have a knock, you know, you tend to go home, go back to mammy's, and, you know, sort of recoup and recover and then fly back out. Like, I didn't really have that option. So, first time I ended up homeless, I was in student accommodation, and then my lease ended for the summer, and I couldn't get another place after. You know?
Yeah, and if you, as you say, if you had mammy or daddy at home when that happened, you would have just returned home. But when you come out of state care at 18, there's real gaps there, isn't there, in that system? You get looked after up to the age of 18. Now, you might be moved from pillar to post, but you are given shelter and comfort and food and whatever. But then at 18, when you're not really an adult, you're almost left on your own.
Ah, yeah. I mean, the world's a completely different place now than it might have been in the past. You know, like, how do I put it? Like, yeah, unfortunately, if you don't have somewhere to call as a home base, you know, until you set up your own, you're kind of just fecked over completely. Mm. Like, if you think about it, most people would be paycheck to paycheck if, you know, they're young. Deposits when you're leaving a lease or your lease is finished, they take a while. You know, the landlord will have to go and assess the place and then hand back the deposit. So there's always going to be, you know, short bursts of gap time, no matter what situation you're in when you're young. And the default backup in that case would be to go back to mammy's and daddy's maybe for a week or two
while you get sorted. And yeah, what I think is very unusual, Cian, about your case as well of homelessness, you don't have any addictions. You're not a drug addict. You've never been a drug addict. You're not an alcoholic. You've just fallen through the cracks and found yourself with no place to live, to the point of you were working in construction. You had a full-time job, but yet you were leaving the work site and sleeping where?
I used to alternate between Dawson Street in Dublin and the Boardwalk in Dublin, and then on the O'Connell Bridge Boardwalk, and occasionally Tariff Street. It was just a case where, you know, like, I don't know. It was just, you know, you go to view a place to rent, and if you manage to get a message back in Dublin, and there'd be thousands there looking at it, and they might break it up, and there might be a couple hundred going in to look at it at once, and they throw out all the sheets, and you fill in your income and all this crack to see if you get to the next stage. And, it was just a stupid existence, like.
Yeah. And yet you turned up for work every day. Obviously, the most important thing was to have the phone charged so the alarm could go off to get you to work.
I was gassed. Like, I chanced the hostel once in Dublin. I was in Isaac's Hostel. And then at 4:30 in the morning, 5:00 in the morning, I was getting up to go to work. And I got strangled by a chap because I wasn't Romanian in the room, and still went to work. I had to fight him off, you know, and then just got my stuff and went to work the full day, did my full day's labour, and then ended up finding a bench to sleep on.
So you felt safer sleeping rough on the streets and on benches rather than going into a hostel?
I mean, you got to remember, a hostel is an enclosed space, you know, whereas you're, you know, there's, how do I put it? If you're sleeping on the streets, you know, people will have to think twice if someone's going to walk by or to try to do something dodge. But if you're in a hostel, it's an enclosed space. So, you know.
And unfortunately, a number of the people who are in the hostels do suffer from addiction, do suffer from mental health issues. So anything can, anything unfortunately can happen. So you were
higher odds of running into a dodgy person in a hospital than you do anywhere else, really.
Yeah, it's an awful thing to say, but it's the truth, unfortunately, it really is. So Dublin wasn't working out for you. So what prompted you to move to Cork?
Well, I got sick of Dublin because I ended up having my teeth knocked out, my ribs broken in my sleep. And I've no memory of it. And I couldn't work for 6 weeks. And then all my savings, I saved up at that point $6,300, most money I ever had. And then all my savings, because I couldn't sleep on the street, broken ribs, I'd die. I couldn't defend myself. And I couldn't work either. So all my savings were spent on B&Bs and hostels. Within 3-4 weeks, I'd say I was nearly tapped out of cash. So I said, feck this. I went back to work after I recovered. It takes 6 weeks to recover from broken rib. And then, I was just back at square one and I literally felt I was going insane because it wasn't the first time I lost all my cash and, you know, I was just couldn't do it anymore. So I said, feck it, I need to come up with a new plan. What really annoyed me, I was trying to get my driver's license, but they needed a solid address. They wouldn't take care of address. But anyway, so I said, feck this, started looking at going towards England. I said, I'll try my luck in a different land. So went to England and, I got a place rapidly, to be fair. I got a place within 3-4 weeks, but I just couldn't afford. I was working on and off and labouring and bartending, but unfortunately, the rents and subsidies and all that, you ended up fucking starving most of the month, like, unless you're relying on food banks. And so in the end I stuck at that for a year and then I couldn't hack it anymore. I just couldn't hack, you know, starving for most of a month. So I said, fuck this, I'll come back to Ireland. So I went back to I came back to Ireland and spent the last of my cash on a burrito, or 3 or 4, I think. And then I said, I'm not staying in Dublin. There's nothing to keep me in Dublin. So I said, where else will I go? And then I thought, sure, I'll give Cork a go. I picked it at random, to be honest.
How did you get on when you hit the city?
To be honest, Cork is miles, miles better for a rough sleeper in Dublin. Like, a lot of the other people on the streets were looking out for each other and, you know, I made friends fairly quickly. You know, it was a good deal, safer, you know. Now, I have to say, you know, if I had started my homeless journey off in Cork, I'd say I would have been able to have a better time.
Might have been a different story. And then, of course, there's the wonderful charities. I'm assuming you interacted with the likes of Katrina Toomey at Cork Penny Dinners.
I see. But at that stage, I was so jaded from everything that I just wasn't eating. I just said, here, if I can't have everything consistently, I'm just not going to eat. So, or I'm not going to engage with any of this nonsense. Otherwise, I'll be alive till I'm about, you know, late 40s, just sleeping on a bench, watching other people live their lives. So I stopped eating completely, but I did engage with charities. Like, I used to get a cup of tea from Penny Sinners, to a charity run by Katrina Toomey, in the morning. And then late at night, I'd go and I'd have chats with the different soup runs, such as the Kindness Crew, run by Jade, and a few of the others. And I'd get a hot chocolate off them, you know.
But you were eating nothing else during the day?
No, I didn't eat at all. Occasionally, around Christmas time, I started treating myself to milkshakes. But no, I didn't eat food at all.
And your plan was you just wanted to die?
Not really. No, it wasn't about. It wasn't. You know, it wasn't a suicide mission. Like, it was.
What was it?
It was just, like, you think about it, you're forced to live in a certain way just for your birth. And you're meant, you know, people will tell you, ah, Keane, would you not sleep in so-and-so place? There's a bit better shelter. Or, ah, Keane, would you not, you know, do this, that, and the other? And, you know, would you not walk to here to get a free, you know, people trying to optimize what is absolute misery, like, you know. And I was like, I've done this for years. I'm not trying to just lengthen my life for no reason. Like, there's nothing here for me at all. And everywhere around me, I see abundance. So, no, I don't want to engage with it anymore. I want to get out of here. I physically can't get out of here. So I'm going to sit here and I'm not going to engage with any single bit of it until I can figure out a way where I can actually live a half average life. Like,
yeah.
And if there's no path for that, sure, the only way out is, you know, it was either die, you know, it was either starving to death or finding a path out of it. Because at that stage, there was no in-between. I wasn't.
So at that stage, you didn't want to die, but you thought by not eating, you would somehow come up with a pathway out of it.
It was more just, I was tired of compromising myself anymore, you know.
I know. But then this decision to head for the Galtee Mountains, what was going through your head when you decided to walk and head to the Galtee Mountains?
See, I knew from the very start when I started it, that if I stay in the city and I'm not eating, like, the way starvation works is you go unconscious before you die. And, you know, it's just generally how it works. So if I was in the middle of a city and I just went unconscious, someone might walk by, see me unconscious and be like, here, we better ring an ambulance, that chap doesn't look all right. I'd be sent to hospital. I don't even know what to do. With people who are refusing to eat and drink, probably, you know, some form of forced care. And then I would have been sent back out. And life would have continued on until I was in my late 40s. So I said, nah, affect this. I'm going to go for a private spot. I spent 3 months couldn't figure out a path. Extra wound up because I was so skeletal. Everyone, or, you know, average people looked at me and assumed I was on, you know, something like heroin or whatever.
Because you lost so much weight.
Yeah, so anytime I tried to use a public bathroom or anything like that, you know, like, say, the one in the shopping centre where you pay 20 cents or, you know, I'd have someone coming in banging on the door, get out, we're cleaning the place. Because, you know, they'd be afraid I'm going to inject myself an overdose into Jack's or whatever. And I just got so fed up with it that I said, here, now I'm done. So, you know, I was trying to speed it up because, you know, I live... 3 months is a long time. Like I outpaced Bobby Sands. So
you decided to go. You thought the Galtee Mountains, good place to go. I'll find a quiet place there. Nobody will find me, and then one day somebody will find the skeleton remains of a man.
I was just a case where, you know, I felt like I was constantly being forced to do things that I just didn't want to do. It was like, you know, everyone, like, it was even when I had my ribs broken. I was working full time while living on the streets, and then my ribs were broken. Or each time I woke up and something was robbed, or when I was on the streets, you know, everyone just say, ah, try again, you know, you have to keep at it until you get a place, and, you know, all this. And I'm like, why? Why am I building ridiculously expensive apartments that I'll never live in? Why am I doing all this while having zero life myself? I'm not a slave. I'm living a slave life, but I don't want to be a slave. So
there's an irony in that you were building houses to put a roof over other people's heads when you were putting your head down on a park bench in which to sleep. So, OK, you decide to head to the Galtee Mountains and you're walking along and a car stops. Talk to me about that day.
I was strolling down the road and, be fair, I say I looked mad dodge because, you know, I was a skeletal man with nothing but a sleeping bag over his shoulder. I think I had a tent. I did. Mountain. Pulled in and I was thinking to myself, you know, probably, I don't know, they're on the phone or something like that. So I was walking by and, you know, I just ended up seeing one. She kind of opened the door and it later turned out to be Maeve. And, chatting away to her. She offered us a lift and I was telling her I'm heading towards the Galtee Mountains. And, you know, I made it out that it was a sort of, you know, just like a spiritual thing, you know, just it's a hobby of mine to climb mountains and, you know, and just chatting away to her. And you could tell she was a lovely woman. But she sort of sussed and then called it out that she's like, you're not homeless, are you? And I go, nah, sure. I have options, you know yourself. And so, yeah, she dropped us off there. She, you know, she offered us pack of tuck biscuits, and I didn't want to let on that I wasn't eating. I was like, oh, yeah, cheers. You know,
And off you headed into the Galty Mountains.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I ran into two other nice people when I was up the mountains. They saw us, thus something was wrong as well. Two chaps, but...
Yeah. And then what happened was, I think it was Maeve who had stopped. She saw on social media, actually it was the Kindness Crew who you were talking about, used to give you the hot chocolate at night. They were worried about your whereabouts and they put up a message to say, has anybody seen this man? And actually, I remember seeing those posts saying, had anybody seen this man? And then it was between Maeve and other local people in Kilbeheny. They realised it was you and where you were. And then Maeve came with hot chocolate to try to persuade you to at least have a drink of hot chocolate.
Yeah, that was gas. As I was, I got caught, as you know, and then as I was chatting to her and another nice chap.
Okay, your phone line is breaking up ever so slightly and I need to take a commercial break. Will you stay on the line there, Keen?
No, better.
Yeah, because your phone line is just breaking up slightly. I'm just going to take a quick break and hopefully it might clear. I'll just take a break and we will be back in just a moment.
Cork Today on C103.
With McCarthy Insurance Group, proud sponsors of the Cork GAA Club Football Leagues and Championships. They don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk. CMIG.ie.
The C103 Cork Diary is a free service to help non-profit organisations all over Cork. So, if you're a community group or a charity that's holding a fundraising event or meeting, send us the details at least 1 week in advance and we'll tell Cork all about it. Email info@c103.ie. The Cork Diary.
With Cork County Council, making Cork County the place to live, work, visit and invest in. See corkcoco.ie.
C103.
Email Patricia now with your story or comment. corktoday@c103.ie.
Cork Today on C103.
And I'm chatting with a remarkable young man, Cian Murta, originally from County Meath, who unfortunately found himself homeless. And he's outlining to us, I suppose, the story of how homelessness can break somebody. He found himself in the Galty Mountains where he felt he'd had enough. Life was just too hard for living. And Cian, that's where some local people in Kilbeheny decided to help you. They persuaded you to come down off the mountain. And did you then end up in hospital?
Yeah, I was in the hospital for 20 days.
And while you were in hospital, did you know what was happening in Kilbeheny?
To be fair to the Kilbeheny community, they were dead class. Like, they used to visit us a lot when I was in the hospital. Like, and yeah, they were sort of... They told me about the idea of the GoFundMe, but I was very sceptical of the odds of it working, you know, because I thought to myself, you know, sure, I've been homeless for years. I was on the TV before and documentary about homelessness, you know. I thought, you know, it was just, you know, it was basically just a statistic, so I didn't see any odds of it panning out. You know, this is, life isn't an American film, you know. But,
there isn't a fairy tale ending, but there does appear to be a fairy tale ending for you. Stay there, because I want to bring in one of those Kilbeheny locals, and this is Carmel O'Gorman, who is part of the team who set up the GoFundMe page. Good morning to you, Carmel.
Good morning, Patricia.
You decided to set up a GoFundMe page, and it's called Finding a Home for Cian.
Yeah.
What was it about Cian that prompted you all to react?
Well, when we went to the mountains on Sunday, January the 14th, and we persuaded him to come down off the mountain, we visited him then for nearly three weeks in hospital, and we could see that Cian was a very nice guy, and we decided we wanted to help him.
So you set up a GoFundMe page with the idea of what? Of buying Cian a house?
That was the initiative, yeah, to buy Cian a house, yeah, if we got enough money raised.
And how did the fundraising go?
The fundraising went brilliant. There's over 70,000 in it now, Patricia.
And you bought a house?
Yeah, we bought a house, yeah. Yeah, in Sligo for him, yeah.
And Cian, tell me about the house in Sligo.
Ah, sure. It's an old one now. The last long-term occupant was in it from the 1920s, and God knows how long it was occupied before that. But so it needs a lot of work. But you know, it's class. You know, it's going to be a home base. So you know yourself, if I ever have any accidents again, where you know the ribs are broken or whatever, I'll have somewhere to go to recover.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. You have your own home, and obviously the fact that you're a builder by trade, will you be able to do a lot of the renovation work yourself?
Yeah. There's a good bit of stuff where you have to bring people in because you know of regulations, but general maintenance and stuff, I'll be able to do that. Like.
And are you, I'm assuming you're just blown away by the kindness of absolute strangers and all of the people who've donated to your GoFundMe?
It's insane. Like, I'm dead grateful, you know. It feels like one of them, I don't know, how do I put it? It feels like I was on a motorway going top speed and then suddenly there's a massive U-turn, you know.
And are you keeping in contact with the people in Kilbeheny? Because you're in you're in Sligo now, aren't you?
Yeah, I know, we do still chat quite often, you know, they're very nice people, you know.
Carmel, you're staying in contact with Cian?
I am, yeah. Cian actually stayed with us for 5 weeks after coming out of hospital. He stayed here in my home, and all I have to say is that you couldn't meet a nice or genuine guy.
Yeah.
It was a pleasure to have him in our home for 5 weeks.
Well done, dear. And I love the way Cian described the people of Kilbeheny as dead class. And Cian, I'll back that up because the good people of Kilbeheny many years ago did a number of fundraisers. I used to be involved with a hospice helping children that were dying in Belarus. And every single year they did fundraisers for years and years to keep that little hospice going. They are dead class. You've summed that word up well. And Cian, the long-term plan now is to get the house up and running and this will be your forever home. Have you managed to find work locally? Are you looking for work in Sligo?
See, the biggest issue at the moment is trying to get the power on, and one of the steps towards that is being able to pay for power. And for that, I'll need a bank account. My Irish bank account shut down when they inexplicably added a €6 per month charge when I left England. So, I have to try to get a bank account, and unfortunately, for like many things, for getting a bank account, having a house isn't enough. You need a utility bill to send to the house as proof of address. And unfortunately, I can't get a utility bill without a bank card.
Okay, have you anybody in Sligo? Is there a citizens information office? Do you know in
Sligo?
Oh,
yeah, no, there are. Yeah, you need nice to. People yeah. working with is try. Sort that out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of them
catch-22s.
It's just an absolute pain. Yeah, hopefully we'll be able to get around.
You will.
It,
right? You absolutely will. You're on the right path now, and you're staying focused. You're on the right path. And what is the view of your world today? And how do you now see your future unfolding?
I do kind of have the image in my head of me sitting in the cottage, coming back from work, sitting in the cottage, just with the air fryer going, making myself some nice bit of grub. And yeah, I'd say it would be nice comfort and stability, which is, you know, the main thing to sort of seek out, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the kettle will always be on if any of the gang from Kilbeheny call for tea.
Oh, easily, yeah.
All right. And Carmel, the fund is still open if people want to donate, because obviously Cian's going to need, once he gets all the work ready and done on the house, obviously items have to be bought, Carmel, for inside in the house.
Exactly, Patricia. Yeah, the GoFund is still open and people can still donate to us.
Okay, and the GoFundMe is finding a home for Cian, and you're over the 72,000 mark, which is terrific. Carmel, tell me who found the house and how did you go about buying the house?
Well, Maeve and Moss Fitzgerald from Kilbinny, I think they went online and found the house in Sligo, and they contacted Cian and sent him the link of it. And Maeve and Moss travelled up to Sligo and went to see the house with Cian, and they made a bid on it, and it was accepted.
Okay, and you, Cian, you didn't care where in Ireland, you didn't have a preference on what part of the country you wanted to live in?
Ah, no, sure, you know, it was a case of, you know, where it was manageable, like, you know, like, yeah. An equivalent property in North Cork, for instance, probably started at 100k, like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you certainly have made roots, and you certainly have surrogate families in Kilbenny, which is fantastic, Cian, and long may that continue. Look after yourself, and it's a great story. Carmel, to you and the gang in Kilbenny, once again, you blow me away, and it's just, as I said at the outset, it's just one of those gorgeous stories showing humanity at its very, very best, and just congratulations to everybody who's helped out in any way. And Cian, we wish you nothing but love and luck for the future, and we thank you for joining us on the programme this morning.
Cheers, Patricia.
Good morning to you. Bye-bye. Thank you, Carmel. The Killarney listener, I'm assuming, enjoying my chat with Michael Fortune of folklore.ie, but all the traditions associated with May Eve and May Day tomorrow. Killarney listener says, OMG, Patricia, if we lose our traditions, we lose everything. Yeah, so I suppose, yeah, that's why I always like to sort of do features around these time on the different traditions, just purely as well, I think, to jerk people's memories and get people to remember things that maybe their parents or their grandparents did. It would be, that's why people like Michael Fortune and the work he does. He's a primary school teacher in Wexford, but the amount of work he does on folklore and going around the country and recording stories from older people so that those stories will be there for future generations. Thank you for your text, 0862 103103. Some commentary coming in with regard to Cian, who I spoke with, the young homeless man who now has a forever home, thank God, thanks to the kindness of strangers and the goodness of the people of Kilbenny. John O'Donovan in the city said it was heartbreaking listening to Cian's story on your programme today. Doesn't it go to show that once young people leave state care, they really are abandoned? It doesn't matter how vulnerable they are. There are no modular homes for people like Cian and others who come out of state care at 18, and yet we're able to provide modular homes for others who arrive into this country. John says the system really is disgusting that these people are left behind. And you would wonder as well that if you were to go out onto the streets and look at the people, the rough sleepers and the people who do end up in addiction, and thankfully Cian didn't go down that road, but I wonder what percentage of them have come out of state care and there was just no follow up and no backup and no place to go to call home. And we all go into adulthood and we like to think our lives will all pan out beautifully, but every now and again we'll always need family, you always need somebody to be able to pick up the phone, even if it's just somebody to talk to. But at times you may need the love and support and your family to wrap their arms around you, and for young Cian, he doesn't have that, he doesn't have it, which is just utterly, utterly heartbreaking. Well done, Patricia, with all the awful things that are going on everywhere in this country and in this world. Isn't it so uplifting and heartening to hear? We haven't totally lost it yet. I wish Cian all the very best and all the happiness in the world that is possible. And someone else says, Patricia, as a mother of sons, my tears have turned to sobbing listening to Cian on your programme today with his devastating story of homelessness. For a young Irish lad to have felt, there's nothing for me here, that's totally heartbreaking. God bless those beautiful, caring people in Kilbenny who loved him and have decided to, who have helped him and have decided to look after him. Ireland, we may have political problems and we may have things wrong in this country, but thank God we still have the most decent citizens in the world, and we do. They are incredible people. And just to let you know, somebody else was asking about the GoFundMe page. They've actually changed the name of the GoFundMe page to Building Kids Kean's Future Home Renovation Fund. But if you just type in GoFundMe, if you just put in Kean or Kean in Kilbeheny, it will come up. It was initially called Finding a Home for Kean, but obviously they're moving it on. It's evolved now because they have the home, but now they need, he'll need help to renovate it. You know, it's an old cottage in Sligo, so he's going to need help. He'll do a lot of the work himself, bless his little heart, but he'll need help with the renovation work. And then obviously when it is renovated, he's going in there with the clothes on his back, and the clothes on his back are the clothes that fitted in a bag, because that's, you know, as a homeless person, that's all he had. So he will need, he will continue to need a lot of help, and I know that's where the good people of Kilbeheny will keep a careful eye on him and will look after him. So it's Building Kean's Future Home Renovation Fund up on GoFundMe if you have any spare bit of money at all that you would like to donate. And remember, I always say to people with the GoFundMe pages, it's great if they're, you know, you'd love to think there are people listening that have lots of money and would just be able to give thousands upon thousands of euros. But all of the GoFundMe pages that I've ever been involved with over the years, it's all of the small donations. They are the ones that have the biggest impact on those funds. For example, I mean, they've gone over 70,000 in the fund for Kean, of which 41,000 obviously was the buying of the house. So now they're collecting the money. They need additional funds now for the renovation work. But that came from 2,300 donations. So a lot of those donations were small donations, you know, like a 10, 20 euro, 50 euro, whatever people can afford. So if you have anything and you are touched by Kean's story and you'd like to help him, just, I think, to renew his faith in humanity as well, because I think as he started to tell his story, and he's, you know, his story unfolded, you could see when I got to the part of him talking about Kilbeheny, you could almost hear a lift in his voice, and he's on the right path now, and long may he continue on it. 0818 103 103. Good morning, Patricia. Well, the rubbish has started coming in the post. I got 7 European candidate letters in my post box today. I don't even know the man, and I'm assuming there's 7 votes in the house for Mora. I don't know the man, and I don't want to know him. European literature is litter in my book, and it's gone straight to landfill. That's from Maura. Well, can I tell you, can I ask you please, Maura, take it out of the landfill bin and at least put it into the recycling bin where it can be recycled.
Email Patricia now with your story or comment. Corktoday@c103.ie.
Cork Today on C103.
And can I just give a very quick reminder? I mentioned this yesterday, but I just want to give a quick shout out to it again, that there is a low-flying aircraft that's going to be flying around parts of North Cork, generally speaking around the Mill Street, Kanturk areas. It'll come just to outside Mallow, and it'll go down as far as Bandon. It's part of the TELUS survey. It's a national programme that gathers geochemical and geophysical data across Ireland, and they're examining the chemical and the physical properties of the soil, the rocks and the water, and they do these surveys all over the country. But the problem is that when they fly in rural areas, they can cause and unsettle sensitive livestock, particularly horses, and that's why they always ask us to give advanced warning. And they're coming up to the stage now where they are going to be in the right across County Kerry, but they're coming into northwest Cork and neighbouring parts of Limerick, so they are going to be very much in our area. But it is a very low flying plane. You can clearly see it. It's got a red tail on the back, and it's got the word survey, and it's low enough that you can actually read the word survey. It's a little twin propeller plane, so it is quite noisy as well. The noise is described as, you know, like a heavy goods vehicle driving past your front door, that kind of a noise. So for people not to be worried about it, that's what they're doing, and they're in the Kerry, northwest Cork area at the moment. But if you have very sensitive livestock and you'd like to find out exactly when they're going to be in your area, you can call them at 1-800-45-55-65, 1-800-45-55-65. And I'm going to take another very quick break, and then we're back with Joe Heffernan.
Cork Today on C103
with McCarthy Insurance Group, proud sponsors of the Cork GAA Club Football Leagues and Championships. They don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk. CMIG.ie.
C103.
And Joe Heffernan joining us. Good afternoon to you, Joe.
Good afternoon, Patricia.
And we're at that time of year where tomorrow, with the 1st of May, we're getting very, very close to state exams. And it's usually the time when the nerves start to peak. And even there'll be exams, there'll be school exams for some students. And some students just unfortunately get very, very nervous in the run-up to exams. So we want to give a little bit of help, particularly to parents, because I'm very conscious that many of the students are in school today, but we'll have tips for the students as well. But I suppose the one thing for all, for parents, particularly for the state exams and the Leaving Cert in particular, and the Junior Cert, because it's the first state exam, is to encourage, to be as encouraging as you can.
Absolutely. And to kind of, without minimising the importance of it, to say, look, it's not the end of the world. You know, you're loved here at home, and you still will be, whether the marks are up in the air and brilliant or whether they're not as good as we hoped. And, you know, to make it clear that that this is not life or death, you know, it's important, but to kind of put it in its context, you know.
Yeah, and young people today are under enough pressure without the parents. And the parents nagging is probably the wrong word, but trying to say, why you should be studying, why aren't you studying, why, what are you doing, you know what I mean? You need to just ease off a little bit on what would be perceived by young people as pressure, adding additional pressure.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, as we hinted at recently, and we'll speak a bit more on in our time, would be, you know, the enormous pressure that young people are under today. You know, between social media and all of that, that, you know, I really feel for young people at the moment that, you know, we had it a little bit simpler.
Yeah, even that whole points system, you know, and we're constantly at pains to point out that you don't always have to go to university to get to your end goal. But there seems to be, and I don't know, and, you know, maybe I'm wrong in the schools. I don't know whether the focus is from the school's point of view or not, because all the schools love to celebrate when they can come out and say 90% of their Leaving Cert class went on into third level education. But it isn't all about third level education.
It's not indeed. And I mean, even looking at it from a point of view of employment and etc., I mean, I could have 20, 30 graduates here in the next 5 days if I badly, badly needed one of them. But, you know, I wouldn't find it too easy to get a tradesperson.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, we need to kind of broaden our horizons. There was a time, I agree with you completely, that, you know, it was like Junior Cert, Leaving Cert College. And it can be Junior Cert, Leaving Cert apprenticeship. Mm. And that's something that is beginning to be looked at. And that's a very good thing.
Well, we have to, because we're running out of tradespeople. You know, and you can have a fantastic career and earn a great potential to earn money from a trade. So we've got to keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so back to the parents and the studying.
Yeah.
Now, you're saying ask the young person if there's anything that you can do for them. That's a simple enough request.
Yeah. Very simply, is there something you would like me to do? And there might be a request about A or B or C, and, you know, you might be surprised at the request, but you won't know if you don't ask. And here are simple things as well, like, you know, if there are young children in the home as well, to do your best to give the student their space where they're able to do their bit of study and that in peace, and that they're not, you know, that they're not distracted by this, that, or the other thing with the young people. So, you know, everyone in their own home will know what to do about that.
Yeah, and if there's a weekend where a young person is planning on doing a lot of study and you do have young children in the house, maybe arrange that the younger children go on a play date or you take them out somewhere so that it's a nice, quiet environment for the person that's studying.
Absolutely, and that's a win-win situation. Everybody, the younger and the older, would like that. So, as I say, that's a win-win. And sometimes a small thing like, would you like a cup of tea, can help. It shows concern, it shows consideration. You know, I think in life we all like to hear the question, would you like a cup of tea? Yeah. And the student who is hopefully arranging at least for the study, if not already well into it, would appreciate that too.
Yeah, and it's yeah. a small thing that you can do. But for the parents, the big thing is to stay as positive as possible.
To be positive and to be as relaxed as you can be as a parent, because it is a pressure situation and, you know, you don't want to add to it. And you know the way that we can pick up on tension, that if somebody is uptight and preoccupied around the place, the student will pick up on that too, and that won't help, you know. And as well as that, to make allowances. I mean, the young person is under pressure. You know, there might be a snappy answer to a question that one would feel that that was a bit snappy. And to understand, look, the young person is under pressure, and you know, we can all be a little bit abrupt. When we are under pressure.
Yeah, don't take it to heart.
Exactly, make allowances.
Yeah. But it can be a very stressful time for the parent, particularly, I think, if it's your first son or daughter heading into leaving cert, it can be a very stressful time. And that's where you've got to try and be as relaxed as possible.
Exactly. I mean, you know, add to the bit of serenity that's available rather than adding to the pressure. And you're spot on there that, I mean, especially if it's the first outing for one of the children to engage with one of the state examinations. And indeed, I mean, I have known young people that I would have worked with that, you know, even the in-house school tests, some people are very, very susceptible to anxiety about exams. And again, you know, to understand that and that where possible to alleviate the pressure, but definitely not to add to it, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, stay as calm as you can, even though on the inside you might be.
Exactly. And it might seem a bit early, Patricia, but I mean, a study timetable, a schedule, is a good idea at this point in time. There's nothing to be gained in having a mad rush in a fortnight's time. Now is the time to kind of set out a realistic timetable, allowing a certain amount of attention for each subject, and the young person will know where they need to put in a bit extra time for certain subjects, and the ones that are, you know, relatively stress-free. So, and don't forget that when a timetable is made out, this would be broad strokes now of a timetable at this stage. I mean, it wouldn't be 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3:30. It would be a little bit more, a little bit looser in the time factors. But to have a fair picture of what needs to be done. For example, you know, to have the books, the notes, the whatever, separated for each subject. That everything isn't piled on top of each other, because being calm now and looking after oneself is essential, and a little bit of order and preparation.
Yeah, I know you're a big fan of study cards. and reducing the main points. Yeah,
I am. And we might have a word about this towards the end of the month, but definitely reduce. There isn't much point in picking up a textbook to read four chapters, whereas if you can reduce down the four chapters to each chapter to having bullet points, well then that as you're coming closer to the exam, that will do. There isn't much point in thinking, I'll read Hamlet the night before the exam. Yeah. That's just really not on.
Yeah, you're wasting your time. You're absolutely wasting your time.
Yeah,
and back to the mums and indeed the dads, something that they can help the students with is making sure that they're eating like a good diet and that they're getting time out. They can't be, 100% focused on study.
Exactly. And I mean, when a young person, maybe in conjunction with parents and our teachers, is making out what will we call it, a study timetable, to factor in the time off. There isn't, to have it realistic, if a person has found that they're studying from 9 a.m. until 9 p.m., well, it's probably not going to happen. Whereas if 2 to 3 was taking a walk, having a bit of time out, doing whatever the person finds relaxing, well then that will be helpful. But a lot of people have made the mistake in the past of it being work on the timetable instead of it being interspersed with time out.
Yeah, that saying, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, is a very true saying. All right, listen, we leave it there. Joe, a text in saying, great to hear of students doing well in exams, but it always annoys me when I see schools celebrating the success of those who got the very high marks, like the straight A's. I always feel it's very unfair on the others who maybe didn't do as well, and it can be degrading to them. Good luck to all of them. And someone else says, well done to Joe, a lot of common sense today. Okay, that's where we leave it. Have a great week and enjoy the bank holiday, and we'll talk to you next week.
And the same, Patricia.
Thanks,
although
Joe,
the old forecast isn't wonderful.
Ah, well, we'll be ever hopeful. Thanks, Joe. Bye-bye. Joe runs a counselling practice in Bohabui. His number is 086-834-8145. And a County Clare listener picking up with Michael Fortune, who've won the old Pishogue, says, never get married in May or you rue the day. Hi there, Patricia. We got married in mid-May nearly 20 years ago. And I'm glad to report we're still happily married. Well done. Well done. And thank you for that. Okay, that's where I leave you for today. My thanks to John Paul McNamara for producing. Nick Richards is with you for the afternoon. And we will be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of the programme. Until then, I'm Patricia Messenger. A very good afternoon.
Cork Today on C103.
With McCarthy Insurance Group, proud sponsors of the Cork GAA Club Football Leagues and Championships. For motor, home, business, farm, life and health insurance. CMIG.ie.